Before we start this episode of The Ones Who Succeed, I want to send a quick shout out to our friends at E2 Entrepreneurs Exposed. Launched back in 2018, it's now one of the fastest growing entrepreneurship podcasts in Canada, recorded right here in Toronto. Previous guests on the show include interviews with folks like Bruce Linton of Canopy Growth, Skip the Dishes co-founder Jeff Adamson, Mike Geddes of Endy, Brian Scudamore, founder and CEO of 1-800-GOT-JUNK, Michael Hyatt, founder of Blue Cat Networks, Brian Smith, founder of UGG Boots, and many other impressive entrepreneurs. You can listen to their show wherever you get your podcasts. Just search E2 Entrepreneurs Exposed. That's E2 Entrepreneurs Exposed. This week on The Ones Who Succeed, a conversation with Bedrock Capital founder Jeff Lewis.
Something that's a narrative violation at one moment in time could be an accurate narrative, a conventional popular narrative at another moment in time. Lyft was a narrative violation. Everyone thought Uber was going to take the market back in 2012 when I invested in Lyft.
That's this week on The Ones Who Succeed. I'm Campbell Barron. Welcome to the program. Jeff is the founder and managing partner of Bedrock Capital, a venture firm that boasts a portfolio including Lyft, Wish, The Athletic, Cameo, and more. Prior to founding Bedrock Capital, Jeff was a partner at the prominent venture fund Founders Fund. Furthermore, he's the host and creator of the video series Temp Check with Jeff, where he shares his thoughts and ideas on all things tech and venture capital via short-form, bite-sized videos on Twitter and YouTube. Temp Check is how I was actually introduced to Jeff, and today I'm delighted to have him on the show.
Hey, I'm Jeff Lewis. I'm an investor, co-founder of a firm called Bedrock. We're a technology investment firm currently managing around $1 billion in assets. We founded the firm about 3.5 years ago, and our mission is really focused on finding these entrepreneurs who are building these counter-narrative companies, these companies that are overlooked or underestimated because they're incongruent with popular narratives. And we've kind of coined this phrase, narrative violations, and we say that we're in search of narrative violations, these companies that violate the narrative in one way or the other. And thus far, it's been an incredible journey, and we're still just getting started on it. Before founding Bedrock, I was an entrepreneur myself and was a venture capital investor at a firm called Founders Fund in Silicon Valley for about 5 years.
And where'd you grow up? Where are you from?
Canadian. I grew up in Calgary, sort of, you know, pretty close to the mountains, Western Canada. Initially a very idyllic childhood. So it was sort of my very young years were very idyllic. I was quite a happy kid. As I sort of grew older, there were sort of some cracks in my family, some issues, some struggles with addiction with my parents and other issues. It became less idyllic as I grew a little bit older. And so when I went away for university, I wanted to kind of get as far away as possible from Calgary, moved to the other end of the country in Canada, went to school in Ontario, where I think you're from, Campbell, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I am. Toronto.
That's right. I went to Queens in Canada. There sort of was bitten by the entrepreneurship bug, really felt like I wanted to ultimately get to the United States and basically built my career here in Silicon Valley, New York, and over the last, you know, decade plus.
At what point did you move to the U.S.?
I moved to the U.S. shortly after graduation in 2006.
I see. So I want to spend the majority of this interview talking about kind of everything under narrative violations. But if you can just provide the brief story in regards to how you got into venture via Top Guest, I'd love to hear it.
Great. Well, so it was a sort of very atypical path into venture for me. So I, you know, initially was sort of working at a hedge fund in New York, founded by this guy, Peter Thiel, and I was working there. It was a really interesting experience, learned a lot. But my timing for getting into the finance industry wasn't very good because I joined the hedge fund a few weeks before Lehman Brothers collapsed. And so I was there in 2008 through the financial crisis, sort of witnessed that firsthand and kind of it had been a bit of a deviation from what I originally wanted to do, which was something more entrepreneurial, more technology focused, and decided to leave the hedge fund with a friend of mine. We're office mates. We became friends, and we started a startup for all of the wrong reasons. So now I advise folks that you should only start a startup if you have an idea that you just have to see created in the world, something that you're ultra passionate about. We started a startup because we really didn't have any better ideas of what we wanted to do. We wanted to be entrepreneurs, and that was kind of my motivation for starting a startup. So our initial idea was super half-baked. It was kind of an early version of Pinterest meets Instagram, where you could sort of tag brands and photos. We called it Udoors. It was a horrible name. We got no traction. We sort of launched on stage at the TechCrunch conference in 2000 and got a bit of hype up front, but then no traction. And it was sort of this year and a half process of like realizing that we had a horrible product with new users and didn't know what we were really going to do. Our investors, we'd raised about $500,000 in seed financing from Founders Fund, because I had the prehistory after working for Peter at Clarion, the hedge fund. They, I think, had basically written us off and assumed that it was just going to be a loss for them. And then we pivoted the business into TopGuest, which basically was a, I kind of call it now Cambridge Analytica for loyalty points. And so we're basically harnessing all of these data sources, these social data sources, on the back end, marrying social data with user profiles for folks who are members of things like United Mileage, Hilton Honors, Star Preferred Guest, American Express, membership rewards, et cetera. We managed to get that business to like moderate scale and sold it and turned what, quite honestly, I thought was going to be basically a career-destroying failure into sort of a minor success. And so sort of a 2-3x outcome for the investors. They were all shocked because they were sure they were going to lose their money. I made a little bit of money for the first time in my life, which was great. And I think from that experience, I sort of developed a pretty cool network of entrepreneurs building companies. We sort of had this support group that we called Founder Therapy, and I got to meet some really cool founders through that. And identified some really interesting companies early on. So things like Uber, like Lyft, when they were first getting started, several other businesses, and was always telling the folks at Founders Fund about companies that I thought were cool, such that after I sold TopGuest, they invited me onto the team as sort of really a trial back in 2012 to see how I would do it investing. And it ended up just being this incredible trajectory for me. So I got very, really, really lucky there.
So Founders Fund was obviously a pivotal experience in your career. You were able to get on some pretty impressive cap tables as a result of Founders Fund and through Founders Fund. And so as a result, like, you had this very impressive career. You were this partner at this firm. Like, what was the underlying force that led you to go out on your own?
Well, it's a good question. I asked myself that question a lot after I made the decision. I didn't realize how hard it was going to be. To be honest with you, to start up a new firm, it was much harder than I anticipated. But, you know, ultimately, you know, sort of fast forward. So I started Founders Fund in 2012. As you mentioned, this was managed to partner with just phenomenal entrepreneurs in the very early days. Lyft, where I led the first institutional financing round and served on the board. Nubank, where I led the Series C at sort of a sub $500 million valuation and was the director there. In 2015, on several others around the world. And by 2017, really felt like I'd learned a ton from the Founders Fund team and had grown a lot as an investor through the companies that I was able to work with as an investor, as a board member. And quite honestly, financially, on a look-ahead basis in 2017, I was sort of further ahead than I'd really, you know, ever dreamed I would be as sort of someone in my very early 30s. And I felt that for the first time in my life, I sort of had a baseline level of financial security. As someone who grew up, honestly, quite poor, all these financial struggles as a child, was sort of in my early 30s and felt, okay, I've got a baseline level of financial security. Do I want to just keep doing what I'm doing, or do I want to go for a big swing and ultimately try and build something from the ground up? And ultimately, I'd say the biggest difference has been really in building a firm, it's much more about systems thinking. So it's sort of on all of these levels, you have to think at a systems level. So it's a portfolio construction, team construction of the team here at Bedrock. There's sort of all these levels on which the thinking has to be a little bit different versus when you're a partner investing at an already established firm. And quite honestly, when I joined Founders Fund, it was clearly a successful venture capital firm, but it wasn't the behemoth that it is today. It was kind of still a startup firm when I joined. And I really liked that element of playing a small role in building the firm alongside, you know, my phenomenal colleagues and partners there. But really wanted to get back closer to the metal of building something from scratch with Bedrock, and felt like if I didn't take the risk in my early 30s, I would never do it because I was just getting too financially comfortable. So I felt I had to take the risk in my early 30s, or I'd never go and do it. And then that was kind of the thinking. But if I'd known how hard it was going to be, I might have never left. I might have just stayed there. It's been much harder than I ever would have dreamed.
Now, in search of narrative violations, we briefly touched on this, but I'd like you to, if you could provide some examples here. This is 100% unique to you. What are some examples of narrative violations?
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Well, we have this letter on our website where we articulate a few of these examples, but basically, you know, they're constantly changing. And so the short answer to that is something that's a narrative violation at one moment in time could be an accurate narrative, a conventional popular narrative that is sort of conventionally viewed as powerfully right at another moment in time. And so, you know, one example, just to pull from our portfolio here at Bedrock, that we think is a pretty interesting narrative violation, would be something like Epirus, which is a defense technology company that we invested in, focused on counter UAS technology. We led a Series B round there. I was a company that was incubated by some friends of mine from 8VC. And basically, when we invested, defense technology, I think, was still pretty counter-narrative. Folks felt like it was just really hard to sell into these branches of the U.S. military, to get these government contracts, that we really had to have ultra-strong inside baseball to do it. Anduril, which is another investment in our portfolio, where we're small investors, I was really on a great executional path, but hadn't yet quite broken out as being the tremendously respected, rightly so, company that it is today. And I think when we made the investment in Epirus, a lot of our LPs were like, what the heck are you guys thinking, investing in this crazy counter UAS company? Now today, defense technology, I would argue, has become the hottest sector, but it was a narrative violation when we did it. You know, another example along the same vein would be Flock Safety, which is a computer vision-enabled crime-solving camera that basically reads license plates, interfaces with the police departments on the back end to help solve nonviolent crime. When we initially invested in that company in 2018 at around a $50 million valuation, folks thought, you know, hardware doesn't really scale. It was a hardware-enabled SaaS business. Peloton was, you know, the closest analog, but that was consumer, and it was several years before they'd IPO'd. And just in general, you know, folks kind of looked at us like we were crazy. On Flock has grown 10x plus from the time we initially invested. And that whole sector of computer vision enabled cameras has really blown up. And now it's sort of viewed as a conventionally hot area, conventionally hot sector. And so we try to find these things that are counter narrative at the moment in time we invest. But ideally, they quite quickly will become seen as conventionally interesting, exciting companies. So that's a little bit about it.
Coming up, I continue my conversation with Jeff Lewis. We'll be right back after this. Welcome back to The Ones Who Succeed. Right. So that makes a lot of sense. Arguably, I love your framing, right? Like, what is a narrative violation 3 years ago might not be today, as, you know, the public perception sways. Something that's, I'm sure you've seen it, you've seen this kind of this wave all over, you know, tech Twitter, but there seems to be this, and maybe not just tech Twitter, but there seems to be this push towards the anti-institution. And one of the complexes that seems to be not under attack, but definitely up for question is the prominence of the venture fund. Because right now, there is certainly a push towards kind of the angel investor or the solo investor or the syndicate, as opposed to, you know, your typical structure of a venture fund. And so as a founder of a venture fund, I'm wondering how you look at that wave, if you really do think that the venture fund industrial complex is under attack, or is this potentially overblown?
Well, I definitely don't think it's overblown. If anything, I think it's underblown. So I think the starting point for us is I would actually push back a little bit on the notion that we're a venture fund. So while we make a lot of venture capital investments, I think the way in which we do it tends to mirror the way in which an individual angel investor would invest. And so in practice, what that means is we have an extraordinarily small investment team. It's myself, my co-founder, Eric, and our other partner, Spencer. There's just three of us on the investment team. We have a very long prehistory. Eric and I have worked together for over 11 years now. I was an investor in his company. I served on his board of directors. We have sort of a mind meld and a symbiosis in how we all think. We all bring different things to the table. We can make decisions extraordinarily fast. And so at the earlier stages, you know, we're either competing with or investing alongside angel investors, small solo capitalist type funds. we move at the same pace they do to make a decision. We move at that, you know, more non-institutional individual angel investor pace. And then at the growth stage or the later stages or early growth stages where we sometimes play like Series B, Series C, we're competing against the large crossover funds. So the Tigers, the D1s, the Altimeters of the world. We also collaborate with them, but we compete with them as well. And they also, their comparative advantage versus venture capital firms is also that they move extremely fast. They're very decisive. They don't care about things like board seats. And we're the same way. So we can move as quickly as a Tiger can to make a decision. We can write a large check. We just wrote a $35 million check in a single investment into a company. So we have the flex to do the small checks at the angel stage, with very quick decision making. Similarly, at the later stages, Series B, Series C, which is about as late as we typically play, like the crossover funds, we don't care about board seats. We also can make very fast decisions. We have the ability to do that given our unique team structure and prehistory. So I think, you know, to the extent venture is getting disrupted by both those ends of the spectrum, I believe we're very well positioned. And then the other piece is that we actually do a fair amount of not typical venture investing. So we hold crypto assets in our first two funds and anticipate doing that in our third fund. We've invested in some things that most venture capitalists wouldn't touch. Certainly our Epirus investment, I think, was something that most VCs wouldn't have been interested in when we initially invested. Something like, we're in an F&B company called Shirley Wines. It's a non-alcoholic beverage company, not really the typical VC thing. And so I think we have a more flexible mandate than most VCs, can move really quickly. But yeah, the disruption is super real. I don't really foresee a future where founders are going to be traveling up and down Sand Hill Road to meet with all of those firms. And the venture firms that are going to win are firms, I would say, like A16Z that are really, you know, evolving their model to be sort of multi-stage, multi-strategy with a great sort of media overlay. Firms that are hyper-focused on deep tech, like a Lux Capital type firm. So I think there's definitely room for venture firms going forward, but it definitely is getting disrupted by the abundance of capital.
What role do you think media plays? You mentioned A16Z, that was going to be a talking point, so I might as well jump to it now, which is what role do you think media plays in regards to a source for deal flow? Because Bedrock, for example, you seem to, I wouldn't say prioritize, but certainly have a personal brand, and that certainly helps feed into kind of the company. And so these are two ends of the spectrum, if you will, because you're not a traditional venture capitalist like A16Z might be. But as a result, you both have some media aspect. Do you think that's kind of the future of the industry where media is needed, whether it's a personal brand or a media arm like, you know, Future?
Yeah, I mean, well, our whole premise, our whole mission is around the importance of narrative and investing in the world. So definitionally, media historically have been the narrative gatekeepers, have been the large historical media organizations have historically been the narrative gatekeepers. So in a world where you believe narrative is extraordinarily important, and it's increasingly difficult to untangle truth from narrative, those two things are not synonymous. We believe that sort of having a voice, being able to convey a narrative that you believe to be true and have an audience for it is extraordinarily important, and not have to go through gatekeepers. So we believe it's very important. We do invest in it. You know, we have invested in building, you know, our own sort of Bedrock brand, our own personal brands, individuals on the team. All that said, I am of two minds on it. Folks have noticed and comment to me that I sort of go through these waves of doing a lot of media stuff, you know, a lot of TV appearances, temp check segments, which is my sort of short form video thing that I came up with. I go through waves of doing it really intensively, and then I'll go like months without doing any media stuff. And the reason why I do that is because I believe if you're constantly on this content creation treadmill, if you're sort of constantly, as an individual, having to constantly create new content, I worry that you can sort of lose some of your humanity in doing that. And so I'm very, very cautious about over-rotating toward becoming like a media personality or Bedrock, you know, content-driven firm. I'm very wary of that happening here, because I think there's a sense in which if you're constantly having to create new content, you start optimizing for all the wrong things. You start optimizing for views and likes and clicks, and you sort of lose some of your humanity and become quite robotic, which I think can actually really hinder one's ability to be a great investor. And so we're of two minds about it. We think it's very important. And at the same time, it can very easily get pushed, I believe, too far if you dial it too far in the hyper content creation treadmill mode. And so we're very worried about doing that. We try and strike the balance here. It's very difficult.
Is that as a result of the size of your team and how you're much more lean? Or do you think A16Z has, to put it in your words, kind of over-rotated in terms of launching their
own
publication?
Absolutely not. No, I think what they're doing is phenomenal. And I'm absolutely a massive fan of those folks, friend with some of the, you know, several of the folks on the team there. I think what they've done is they've basically built out a dedicated organization to lead and run Future. And then they'll pull in folks from the investment team, folks from the A16Z portfolio, their founders, they'll pull them into their media efforts, but they have they've built a machine to run Future. And so they've got their investing teams, and they also have a fully dedicated media team. And I think that's a great way to do it. So what I'm speaking about is not what they're doing. It's more around as an individual. So just speaking for me, Jeff Lewis,
personal brand.
I want to be very careful to not, you know, well, I think I have an interesting personal brand. It seems to have resonated and cut through. You always want to be very careful not to over-rotate on constantly creating content, because I do worry that you sort of risk something quite elemental to being a human in the process.
In regards to TempCheck, which I got to say, I'm a fan, you put out a video a little while ago, but it really resonated with me and I want to touch on it, talking about how Bitcoin in your mind is the world's first financial religion. And I think that was certainly a very interesting way to put it. I'm wondering if you could talk about that. And I'd love to hear more and we can kind of start the Bitcoin conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, there is this, you know, I've long had this thesis that we're going to see a resurgence of religiosity in the West. And so I've sort of believed this to be true for 6-7 years. When COVID hit, I felt like it was really going to be accelerated. And as someone who's been in and around crypto, you know, not super involved, but have, you know, been in and around crypto since 2013, 2014, one of the things that's always struck me about Bitcoin is sort of the religious fervor that it has around it. You know, you've got the charismatic founder, but no one knows who he or she is in Satoshi. So that sort of, you know, really echoes some of the, you know, echoes sort of Christianity. In a lot of ways, you've got the sort of all of the crazy loyalty tests. You've got the different tribes within Bitcoin, the different sects, like the Bitcoin maximalists versus the non-Bitcoin maximalist people. You've got the evangelical element with sort of crypto Twitter, Bitcoin Twitter. So sort of all of these quasi-religious elements. And I do think it is the first financial instrument, the first asset that also is, I believe, for all intents and purposes, a religion. I believe that there are hundreds of thousands of people on this planet for whom Bitcoin is their religion. And that's a very powerful, dynamic that I don't actually think is priced into the asset yet at this point.
All right, we're going to take one last quick break and we'll be right back with Jeff Lewis, GP at Bedrock Capital. Stay with us. Welcome back. Now, do you think that's, when you say that Bitcoin is a religion, do you think that's a good thing? Do you think that's a bad thing? Do you think it's a dangerous thing?
Well, the question itself is dangerous, because it's always very dangerous to assign, it's always very dangerous ex ante to speculate on whether it'll be net positive for the world and society that there is this, you know, religious cryptocurrency. Net negative, net neutral. It's really hard to predict. I think actually, you know, there are all these possible scenarios. I mean, I was at a party about a month ago, and this brilliant engineer and entrepreneur sort of had this hypothesis he shared with me that he thinks Bitcoin might actually be the first instantiation of AGI. And that sort of blew my mind. I'm like, that's a really interesting idea. And he's like, yeah, it's sort of like it's this AGI thing. It's trying to, you know, warp all the incentives and get folks to act in strange ways. And he really does believe it's AGI. And I was really taken aback by that. I thought it was a very interesting idea. So given we actually know so little about Bitcoin's origins, like, yes, everything is, you can have trustless transactions. You can read the white paper. Like, you know, there's a lot we know. There's also a lot we don't. hesitant to sort of assign a moral judgment on it, but I do think it's a much healthier quasi-religion than some of the other quasi-religions that are out there. And so you can only assign these value judgments on a relative basis, I believe. And on a relative basis, I'd say it's one of the healthier secular religions out there today. I think there are several others that are much more societally dangerous versus Bitcoin.
Aside from the religion aspect, from a financial aspect, are you bullish on Bitcoin as a means of, you know, financial transactions?
No, I'm not super sold on the transaction narrative. I'm pretty sold on the long-term store of value narrative. It's hard to see right now when there's so much volatility. And I anticipate the volatility will continue for many years to come. But I think over time, the digital gold analogy, I mean, sometimes it's just, you know, sometimes the cliches are cliches for a reason because they're right. And I do think there should be obviously digital gold. And it seems like Bitcoin is the best contender for that. You know, that said, Ethereum, with everything that's happening in decentralized finance and Ethereum really being sort of the core infrastructure underpinning that, I think sort of there is an argument that one should maybe be more long Ethereum versus Bitcoin, sort of still unclear, but I am quite bullish on those two cryptocurrencies on a long-term time horizon. Not to say there's not going to be lots of peaks and valleys ahead. I think it's going to be a hyper volatile several years going forward for those two.
So you think long-term Bitcoin is a viable store of value, but it likely won't replace the US dollar as the day-to-day transaction?
Well, I don't know that the US government would ever allow that to happen. And so there's always this reality that we do live in a society where there is a government, and the government is interested in power, and anything that undermines the power of the government, there's a sense in which the government can prevent it. You know, we always sit in a perfect world, perhaps the government couldn't prevent it from replacing the US dollar. But certainly in a world where Bitcoin replaced the US dollar as the global reserve currency, we'd be living in a radically different world than we live in today. And there'd be so many downstream implications of that. So also very unclear whether that'd be a good or a bad thing. It might lead to actually it could be truly disastrous, or it could usher in a utopia. It's really hard to predict these things.
All right. We can move on from that topic. I have tons of other things I want to touch on. And one of them is Bedrock made an investment in The Athletic. And so, you know, speaking of media, that is a media business, right? Dedicated to sports. And I'm curious because as much as we can say, you know, legacy media is having a really hard time, the New York Times really has seemed to kind of get back up on their two feet and have a decent subscription business. I think the fact of the matter is BuzzFeed and Vice and kind of these next generation media companies have been having a harder time than the New York Times has in the last 6 months. And so I'm curious to hear your thoughts are as an investor in The Athletic, what is your perspective on kind of this future of media? Would you invest in another media publication? You know, what are your thoughts?
Well, media investing is very different from investing in like an ultra high margin, pure play software business. And so it's a different type of thing. You know, the valuations, you'd be much more careful on the valuation side. The Athletic's done a great job of building a really loyal and engaged subscriber base. You know, I think as on a look ahead basis, I'm excited to see them expand the scope of what they do, expand into different form factors beyond, you know, written content. So I think there's actually a lot of room for that company to continue to grow. That said, there is, I think, a cap on how valuable these media companies can actually be. It's not sort of the unlimited, you know, $100 billion upside type story that you really can have with an ultra high growth software company. So on a relative basis, I think these high growth software companies are always kind of the most lucrative investments if you can get in early. That said, when you find an amazing team like the team that's building The Athletic, doing something really different that's actually quite a sort of contra local newspapers, which were very short, you know, it can make sense to make an investment there. We're excited to be invested, but there's a cap. So for example, the New York Times market cap today is like, I think, you know, just under $7 billion. And I think they've had a pretty good, I think they've actually had a pretty, or actually maybe they've had a bad 2021, but I think they've had a pretty good 5-year trajectory if you look at their market cap. And I do think the market caps on these media businesses there is a ceiling on them. And so you have to be careful on the valuations for media investing.
Right. So it's all relative to the valuation.
Exactly.
I see. Now, in regards to your thoughts on consumer, you've invested in Wish and you've invested in Lyft. And in particular, it seems like we've had this new renaissance, this new rise of consumer social, or at least this excitement kind of led by Clubhouse. What are your thoughts on this rise of consumer social?
I'm not very close to Clubhouse, so I've used it a few times. I'm not super closely tracking it, but I definitely respect the founders there and think they created something quite interesting. On the consumer social stuff, I think it, I'm of two minds on it, because on the one hand, it does feel like the current mechanics and the current incentive structures for these social media platforms are very deeply off, where it's sort of these advertising business models, I think, really do warp the behavior and are actually maybe quite, you know, to the extent there's a lot of positive implications, I would argue they're probably several negative implications as well. You know, my partner Eric at Bedrock, he would very much disagree with me on this. He thinks Facebook and Twitter are great and total, like, clear net positives for the world. I think it's a bit more of a gray area for those two. I think there's some dangers driven by the advertising business model. But in terms of the new wave of consumer social, you know, I've been predicting there's going to be a new wave of consumer social for several years. I'm really excited to actually see it happening. I do worry that most of these consumer social things do tend to be fads, A, and then B, I think you have such powerful incumbents now, specifically in Facebook, you know, to a lesser extent, Twitter, Snapchat, but certainly with Facebook, it is such a powerful incumbent that I think it's just very, very hard to come in and compete. Just it's sort of very hard to come in and compete versus Google. If you can actually win versus Google at core search, that's a tremendously valuable company. You can actually win versus Facebook at sort of core, keeping up with your friends, you know, Instagram, WhatsApp, social, that's hyper valuable. But I do worry that the incumbents just have too much power such that the new entrants aren't really going to be able to get the breakout distribution. I think it's actually quite hard at this point. It might be an area where you kind of need a decentralized, you know, on-chain type approach with a totally different business model that's tokenized to really compete in a more asymmetric way. And I think that might happen at some point. You're seeing early innings of that with something like BitCloud, and you could see that really evolving and see other players that are decentralized. But I think to the extent there is a consumer social renaissance, it will likely be a decentralized one if I had to make a prediction.
From a consumer perspective your narrative violation thesis in regards to Bedrock, are you always looking for consumer social deals? Do they get you excited? Are you much more interested in kind of the B2B side? It sounds like many of the examples of narrative violations you've provided seem to lean more towards B2B or even kind of selling to governments, right? Like in the behind the scenes.
Well, look, I mean, in the past, a lot of the narrative violation examples were social. So I think, you know, Lyft was a narrative violation. Everyone thought Uber was going to take the market. They were just black cars and taxis back in 2012 when I invested in Lyft. Lyft was like 12 cars with crazy pink mustaches driving around the streets of San Francisco with normal people driving other normal people in a very regulatory gray area. Uber was not doing peer-to-peer. There was no UberX at the time. That was a narrative violation. And ultimately, what Lyft pioneered with peer-to-peer has now become the, you know, the dominant business for Uber as well, as the peer-to-peer business, not the black car business. So there have historically been phenomenal narrative violations. Snapchat, Tinder, those were narrative violations when they launched. So there were lots of consumer narrative violations. You know, that said, I think the thing that has most surprised me over the past 5-6 years is so much of the value now really is coming from enterprise, is coming from software as a service versus consumer. And it turns out that the market caps of these SaaS businesses are just much larger than anyone really would have anticipated. And I think that trend is going to continue. That said, I do think there is still a lot of interesting opportunity in consumer. Now, I wouldn't necessarily say consumer social, but there's a lot of interesting opportunity in consumer that we're quite excited about. And we're actually working on something right now, an investment that my partner Eric incubated in consumer that we're very excited about that I can't talk about right now. But it's based in Atlanta and it's a really cool company.
Now, when you say consumer, you're not just referring to consumer social. This is kind of consumer as an umbrella. If you had to pick a industry or, you know, an investment type that gets you excited, you know, in the next, let's say, 10 years, would it be consumer? Would it be AI? What would it be?
I'm the wrong person to ask that question because I am very For me, it is like it all stems from the founders and their vision. It stems from the entrepreneurs and their vision. I get excited about the specific people that are coming up with these ideas and building these companies. So for me, it's sort of the person first. It's the founder first. And it's almost sort of the market and business second. So I can get convinced, I can get excited about anything with the right founder and the right strategy and the right sort of technology in place. But the starting point for me is the founder. So I don't really like, I'm not like, I love this category. I'm more like, I love this person as a founder and here's why they're uniquely right. suited to build this business in this market. So I'm actually, I guess what that means in a less, you know, long-winded way would be I'm pretty opportunistic, and I think you never really want to artificially limit one's universe of prospective investment. So I'm always skeptical of firms that say we are only investing in sort of like Southeast Asian enterprise SaaS companies, or we're only investing in, you know, a sort of Middle Eastern fintech. I think you want to sort of have a pretty broad aperture for wide aperture for one's investment universe. Because these good opportunities can come out of all sorts of weird places. And so I don't really like to limit what I'm excited about.
So you're industry agnostic, bet on the jockey.
Well, it's, I don't like to call them jockeys, but bet on the founder company fit. Yes.
Okay, fair. All right, I appreciate your time. Before we wrap up here, I want to touch on, actually, first and foremost, where are you based like right now?
Well, I'm physically in Austin, Texas right now.
Okay, and do you call Austin home?
I do. As of recently, I do call it home. I'm a Texas resident.
All right. So you call Austin home. And I don't know if Austin is necessarily a narrative violation right now. I think maybe it would have been like 10 years ago. Many folks seem to be relocating, leaving Silicon Valley, leaving California, et cetera. I'm curious what your thoughts are in regards to, you know, where to build. We've seen this shift in kind of how we work. Actually, I guess this is my first question, which is the shift in how we work as a result of COVID. Many folks are very bullish on remote. Like Bitcoin is a very divisive topic. Many folks are very bullish on it. Not so much. Where do you fall on the spectrum in regards to in the context of company building, let's say?
Well, I'm someone who I personally like not going into an office every day. So if I was sort of just, you know, designing my own world, I'd probably not be going to the office every day. That said, when you have a smaller team like we do at Bedrock, where there's just a handful of people on the team, like we've only got, I think, six people on our team now. So it's a very, you know, we manage almost $1 billion. So it's a very small team for the AUM. I think you need to spend time together when you're in a small team and you're getting things started. And again, we feel like we, you know, while we're relatively established in the scheme of the investment world, the institutional investment world, we're still a pretty new firm and a new fund, new funds. So I think being together in person is quite important. I think the same is true for many early stage startups, not all, but many. I think you can build remote first from day one successfully. One of our portfolio companies, Vercel, is a great example of that. Guillermo, the founder, has built that company remote first since day one and has done a phenomenal job of scaling that team remote. So it certainly can work. But I think for many early stage startups, when you're first getting started, let's say like sub 30 employees, there are lots of benefits to all being in the same space. There's a lot of camaraderie. There's a lot of stuff that happens being physically together. So I am probably more skeptical of fully remote at the very early stages, although, you know, it can work for some companies. I think once you get to be a big behemoth organization kind of operating on autopilot like Google, going fully remote can definitely work. So I don't know that those companies really want to do that, because I think they would worry about keeping tabs on all their employees if they're all fully remote. But I think it can definitely work. But yeah, I tend to think being in the same place for a meaningful portion of time is pretty important in the early days of building an org. What I'm most skeptical of is what I think is becoming the popular narrative, the most conventional approach, which is the hybrid model. And I'm most skeptical. Right. I'm most skeptical of that. So I actually feel like the hybrid model is most likely the worst of all worlds. And actually, you should either be, you know, fully remote with, like, you know, monthly or quarterly offsites where you all get together or teams get together in person, or, you know, not remote and have different office hubs in different cities. But I do think the era of the large mega corporate campus where like 70% of the employees live in one geographical area, I think that era is over. I think companies that are not going to be, you know, remote distributed are going to have lots of smaller offices in lots of different places.
Now, in regards to cities, right, one of my favorite temp check was where you talked about how Silicon Valley is over and is on Twitter. And I'm wondering if you still stand by those comments and kind of if you are a builder, if you are a founder, how important is it that you are in a specific geographical location?
Well, I'll answer the first part first and then the second, which is I've actually, the last three investments that I've made, the founders actually are not on Twitter. And so I want to walk back a little bit. My earlier claim that Silicon Valley is on Twitter, I think I may have said it's in the cloud.
Yeah,
in the cloud. One instantiation of Silicon Valley now lives in the cloud, manifests, exhibits itself via Twitter. But I definitely am very bullish founders who are not on Twitter. So if you're a founder who's not on Twitter, please contact me. I'd love to talk with you. All that said, I think you can start these companies from everywhere, anywhere, everywhere, because you can reach people like me. You can reach other entrepreneurs online through online channels, and the availability of information, of expertise on how to get these companies going, on connecting with investors, on hiring employees, all lives online, all lives in the cloud. And so you no longer have to be in one physical location. And then you have seen a real exodus of people from the San Francisco Bay Area, such that it's actually even no longer clear that there's an advantage, a network building advantage to being in the Bay Area. That may change, but I'm quite skeptical that it will.
So as if someone's looking to break into startups, do you recommend them moving to a specific city or do you think the cloud basically?
I am always very hesitant to recommend cities to people. And the reason why is because I believe it's so idiosyncratic based on the person, based on their life, based on what they want to get out of the place they live, that I really need to get to know the person and get to know their company before I would say you should move to city X or you should move to city Y. Because I think it's highly person and highly company specific. And the city that's right for me might not be right for you. I really don't think it's a one size fits all type thing. And so I never like to recommend, you know, abstractly a certain city. I want to get to know the person, get to know the company, and then maybe help them figure out what's right for them. I do think that where you live is actually very important, but I also think it's very personal, and there are all these personal considerations that go into it.
It's a great answer, Jeff. I appreciate your time.
My pleasure. Thanks, Campbell.
Jeff Lewis is the co-founder and GP at Bedrock Capital. He joins this program from Austin. Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Ones Who Succeed. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Campbell J. Barron. You've made it to the end of the show. I'm Campbell Barron. Thanks for listening.